This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 2nd of December 2012 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly, in association with Tourism Australia. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 178, with me, Robert Bound, and Sophie Grove.
Today we'll flick through the well-thumbed pages of some second-hand books with Wayne Goodaham, who's made an exhibition out of Marginalia.
We'll get literary wish list from Paul Lay, editor of History Today, who's bringing us his top five books of 2012.
And we'll hear from Shona Marshall of Somerset House about the value of Valentino and why fashion isn't just fit for the runway, but for the gallery too.
Plus, a look forward to next week's news and a tune or two right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. And now look, it's our Sunday afternoon. Here we are, Sophie. It's all right, isn't it? It's been a while. It's cozy. Do you know why it's cozy?
Why?
We've broken all the rules.
We've fiddled
with the air conditioning. That's not a euphemism for something. It's a genuine fact. It was a bit chilly in here, wasn't it? At like 17 degrees, whatever it was when we came in.
It's now actually 23 degrees.
This is essentially the Sunday. This is kind of like the late Sunday breakfast, where we basically feel like we've had a good kind of half cafetière of coffee. We've had a couple of bacon sandwiches, possibly with a fried egg on the side, and beans and mushrooms.
Possibly with a Bloody Mary.
Possibly, but very, very definitely
with a large
with a Bloody
piece
Mary.
Of celery for their vitamin content.
Well, you know what's been happening this weekend? It's been the country fair, the Monocle Country Fair, or Christmas Fair, right?
It's happening as we speak.
What normally happens after these sorts of events is that the pub gets a lot of custom, doesn't it? The Barley Mow, which is a pub near where we are here.
That great
the Tudor
institution.
Rose,
you're name dropping both of them.
I know. I'm just wondering if I keep on saying it on the radio, whether they'll listen in and kind of come in maybe halfway through us recording this show with a pint of Guinness or a Bloody Mary for us. What do you think?
Well, possibly, but I think maybe they're busy with Santa.
All right, maybe they're busy with Santa. We've got to keep Santa topped up, right? We've got to finish Santa for the Christmas fair, right? This is no word of a joke. He's got a real beard. I mean, this isn't a strap-on beard.
It probably is the real Santa. And, you know, we've got to top him up, but he can't get tipsy, because otherwise it would be like one of those awful Hollywood drunk Santas, you know, in the
bad Santa.
Baddies.
Or it would be like a sort of a pending investigation at the BBC about some of their presenters of that bygone age.
Ooh, yes. That is a rather underhand joke, right. Mr. Bound.
Underhand is not the kind of phrase we should be using about this kind of bad Santa, you know. It's an awful thing. But it's okay. This week also saw Alpino disappear out of the office, thank goodness gracious me. Although it looked pretty handsome this year, right?
It's beautiful, yes. It's really got some amazing pictures in there.
And big ones too.
Big ones. It's one of my favourite formats. I mean, even though we love the magazine so much, Alpino's enormous.
You said that, so you sounded like you were joking when you said that, but you do love the magazine a lot.
Of course I do. But I just really love the images of these snowy vistas. I was in Iceland with the most amazing photographer, Rama Knight, and he took some beautiful shots. Reykjavik looks incredible. And then I was back in Reykjavik trying to get to Greenland.
This didn't happen. This
it
was
didn't
this
happen.
Week, right? You're sort of stranded in an airport hotel in Reykjavik.
I've been to Reykjavik twice in the last sort of 10 days.
Oh, who hasn't?
The second was a kind of epic journey to try and reach the north of the, you know, proper Arctic regions. And I was thwarted.
Oh, dear.
I had to come home.
Can you let us in briefly on your wasted day and night in Reykjavik? Because I kind of feel like if you're bored somewhere, you'd have thought, on the face of it, that might be a sort of exceptionally sort of ultra bleak place to be. But I bet it was weirdly quite fun.
It was fun. I mean, I did things like eating minestrone soup with my fellow passengers on Air Greenland. I did things like walking up and down in an industrial estate.
Okay.
And also I went swimming. I walked along the motorway to this most amazing 1970s sort of concrete cantilevered swimming pool that was kind of huge municipal swimming pool with big trees around, and swam in this outdoor hot Olympic-sized pool with Icelanders, and then chatted in the hot tub afterwards.
See, that's pretty good.
And then I came home.
And then Rob, I came home and presented the Monocle Weekly. Hello.
I'm quite glad to be here rather than, you know, stranded in the Arctic.
I don't know whether you've tuned into this show since the new edition. Tom Edwards comes in at the beginning of the show and tells us what's going to happen.
Exciting.
He's got kind of like a, you know, calendar. He calls it a crystal ball, but I think it's a calendar. I mean, I don't know why it gets so much fanfare. He goes, oh, yeah, the UN's meeting on Thursday, and then tells us about it. Anyway, news fans, that's coming up next. Get our first guest out, Sophie Grove.
Yes.
I call him a guest. He's not really a guest. More like a bad tenant when you've got a house and you're letting it out. It's Tom Edwards with the news agenda.
Hello, Rob. Hello, Sophie. How are you both today?
Good, fantastic. Thanks. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Thanks for that lovely introduction.
Sorry. I feel like it should always be, I don't want it to be too cosy. Hey, man, what's up? High five.
Dear,
let's do a high five. See how it sounds. Yes.
Okay. I'm guessing that sounded fairly poor. Let's start with something that's happening tomorrow. Now, does the name Neil Papworth mean anything to either of you?
No.
So, on this day in 1992, the very first SMS was sent by Neil Papworth.
Then Did he invent it?
A 22-year-old test engineer who used his PC to send a message to the phone of his colleague Richard Jarvis. Do you know what it was? It had a kind of festive quality.
Merry Christmas.
Got it in one.
Yes!
He's not the most original thinker, Neil Papworth, except in the world of communications. And obviously, it's gone from strength to strength since. Probably never a day goes by when you get inundated or yourself inundate somebody else with text messages.
With SMS messages.
And we have Neil Papworth to thank.
Thank you, Neil.
So perhaps think of him tomorrow as you text.
I'm 35 right now. When I had my first mobile phone, I had an Ericsson. And you could text on it, but I was the only person who I knew who could have text, so no one could text me, and I could text people and they could receive it, but they couldn't send text messages.
Right.
So it was right in the gold. That was
the first. You should have made friends with Neil Papworth.
Yeah, I could have done that. Then you could keep on. Stop. It's not Christmas anymore.
Leave it, Neil.
If anything, it's Easter. Relax.
Let go. Anyway, I thought that was interesting.
That's great. So tomorrow, Monday, is the anniversary of the text message.
That's right.
Okay, cool.
The day later, on Tuesday, another media story. This one, I think, has a sad quality. It's slightly parochial, but I think our listeners will forgive us. It's the last ever print edition of UK comic favourite The Dandy.
Is it?
It's the oldest of all the UK's comics. It's the 75th anniversary and final print edition. It will continue online. Now, I think that's kind of sad. An indictment of, you know, the dying of certain forms of media. And I think it's a bit of an admission of defeat by the publishers of The Dandy. A peak weekly sales of 2 million from the 50s to the 80s, but by last year had dwindled to just 15,000.
And of course, the big hero of The Dandy, Desperate Dan, with a cow pie.
Absolutely. But can I reassure you, Rob, with these words from the chief executive, Ellis Watson, Dan has certainly not eaten his last cow pie, says Ellis. The digital version will give him a new lease of life.
Although your parents probably bought you your first comic. Like they do, the whole idea was that they were a little bit rebellious and the characters in them were badly behaved. Dennis the Menace and Desperate Dan, all these people. So I guess you can't be reading it on an old school format, because then it makes you not cool in the playground if you're reading The Dandy on paper, I guess. Do you know what I mean? It kind of goes with the territory, doesn't it?
Absolutely. This is a slightly left field one, but I thought I'd throw it in there. It's the World Toilet Summit.
God.
Okay. This is taking place in South Africa. The South African Toilet Organisation, along with the Foundation for Professional Development, are hosting the 12th World Toilet Summit for the World Toilet Organisation. The theme is African sanitation, scaling up dignity for all. And I think that's quite interesting. I mean,
so this isn't about kind of design and functionality. This is about sanitation. This is about the sort of politics of it rather than the.
Yeah, this is really, you know, toilets, you know, at the grassroots.
But we should say that there are lots of really nifty inventions that they've come up with. And Bill Gates is behind some quite interesting ones. So I think we shouldn't write off the day out to the toilet convention quite yet.
Something slightly more serious, perhaps, to end the week's look ahead. On Thursday, it's a very significant day for a number of personal freedoms in the United States. Now, many of these we talked about a little on Monocle 24 because a number of pieces of legislation were sort of introduced and passed coincided with the presidential elections across the nation. A couple of critical ones. The recreational use of marijuana comes into effect in Washington and Colorado on Thursday. Significant numbers in favour of this at the elections. It was sort of won by 5 or 6 points. Also on Thursday, Washington State, so as well as smoking marijuana, it's also joining the list of US states to allow same-sex marriage. So I think in terms of personal liberty, personal freedom, Thursday could be a pretty big day.
There'll be some big sort of parties on Wednesday night.
In Washington
State. On the stroke of midnight, boom.
Absolutely.
I'm unfamiliar with drugs. Do you snort marijuana? What's that?
I don't know. I've only ever heard tell of the legends.
Okay.
But it's going to be an exciting day. And, you know, to celebrate perhaps a same-sex marriage event.
Yeah.
You know, the party, the aftermath.
Everyone can then relax.
People can enjoy their recreational narcotics.
Okay.
And on that bombshell.
So, thank you as ever for a quirky but very strong foursome for the news agenda. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We all love to crack the spine of a new book and breathe in the smell of its freshly printed pages. But there's something to be said, too, for stories told by second-hand books, from birthday dedications, studious marginalia, or an underlined passage.
On Friday, a new exhibition opened at London's Foyle Bookshop that celebrates exactly that, the secret history of second-hand books. Its mastermind is Wayne Goodaham, who's a blogger and collector of used books. He joins us now in the studio to talk about the stories you can build from scribblings in someone else's old books. Welcome, Wayne.
Hi.
Fascinating idea for an exhibition. You've got a pile of books here. When did you get the idea for this?
Well, I buy secondhand books more than new books. I stumbled into it, really. Buying so many books secondhand, you just notice gradually you're collecting books with dedications in them.
Yeah, presumably there was like a serendipitous, a eureka moment where you opened a thing and you thought, hang on. Because we all like to kind of delve through. I'm sure we all like kind of, I love the smell of a secondhand bookshop as well. Kind of delving through things.
I prefer the smell of a new book. That's the thing. I do prefer the smell of new books, yeah.
So this is very much, there's something in the fibre of these dedications that you like. Yeah. More than just the sensuousness of them.
I guess it was a copy of Catcher in the Rye, which was, I guess there were two teenage girls. It was from one teenage girl to another saying, yeah, I know you hate me and you think I'm a bitch, but this is for you to say sorry for what I did. And I just,
brilliant.
You don't know what she did. And I don't have that book anymore. I've lost it over the years. Because this was before I started collecting. And then I got a few more of that standard and then, you know, put them into a pile and thought, actually, there could be something here.
I always find it really intriguing reading a book that's been annotated, especially by somebody you know.
Yes.
Because you can find out so much about their interpretation of it.
I know.
It's so much more entertaining than reading just a normal book, because you can see where they've underlined things in this rather sort of punctilious way. And I wondered, do you think that's a different way of reading altogether? And can you sort of tell something more about the work from the annotations?
You can. I do annotate, but I am wary. I tend to just underline. I tend to annotate just stuff I like.
But this is the point, isn't it? Surely this is the personalisation that you're such a fan of.
But the
kind of like where the life takes on a book of its own and the readers put something out into the world and suddenly, you know, he doesn't know what's happened to his child. He's wandering all over the world and people are interpreting his life.
And I think that's interesting, the way that people... these dedications, and it would be great to hear a few of the examples from the show, but it's very much putting your mark on the book. So it's no longer this sort of anonymous sort of object. It's really something very personal. It's a certain type of person writes in the cover of a book. And I wondered if you get a sense of any of these people really coming through, their real character.
Yeah, well, I mean, this guy who's written in a copy of Hemingway, Winner Take Nothing, short stories, he's just put, it's dated January the 27th, 1988, and he's written, a present from me to me. The message, it's nice when you just don't give a damn. And that's, so you can imagine what sort of person he is, because it's a Hemingway book.
Yes, it's,
and, you know, he's written it to himself.
And it's sort of properly kind of Hemingway and short and sharp and to the point. And slightly selfish.
Yes, exactly. But then the fact
an
that...
An utter bastard, basically.
Sophie, don't be like that.
But
I can't believe my old copy of that book turned up.
He doesn't own the book anymore, is the interesting thing.
And that's the thing. I mean, it would be nice to hear a few more of those dedications, but we should talk about the show and how it's going to work and things as well. So this is going to be at Foyle's, maybe London's most famous bookshop.
Yes.
And it's a great institution itself. You've brought some things in frames and you've brought some books with post-it notes in and dedications. So talk us through what the exhibition is going to look like and how it's going
to
work.
The exhibition will look very similar to my blog, which is the cover of the book and then the the pages underneath. And I've just framed them. They're sort of paperback size.
Let's have a look at this one. Hold this one up. Let's have a look at this. This is like a sort of classic sort of over the fireplace piece, kind of size piece of thing. This one is a bit of a classic. We framed this one for a reason. This dedication is longer than the author's collected works and biography.
Yeah, this is...
Maybe you could tell us about this one.
Shall I just read the dedication?
Yeah, it's very nice. We need to hear it in full.
The book's Mr. Johnson by Joyce Carey. And it's dated May 1991, and it's, Dear John, when I was 12 or 13 years old, Grandma became increasingly alarmed at my Philistine preoccupation with science and agriculture. I remember being whisked off to the bookshop in Bury, where on my behalf she selected Mr. Johnson, my first adult book. It was an inspired choice. It amused me, introduced me to the joys of literature, and also to the notion of an overseas colonial service. The book thus had a profound influence on my life. Without it, I may never have gone to Africa, and you may have not been born 30 years ago. To it, you probably owe your existence, and it's high time you were introduced. I pass it to you, in turn, with much love, Dad.
Wow. No pressure for the rest of them, then. Amazing.
I should have saved that one for last.
That seems like the summation of a great novel in itself. Yeah. What a wonderful thing. So the story sad. Of a life.
It's so sad that the son doesn't own the book anymore. You don't know what's happened.
And I wonder whether certain sorts of novels seem to have better dedications in them than others. Is the Aeneid a much scrawled on book, or is it always this more unlikely sort of books, maybe more unknown authors that seem to get a more personal treatment from people?
I'm not sure, really. I mean,
you've got quite a good stack there. But talk us through what you've got there.
Well, this is like Roald Dahl, More Tales of the Unexpected.
Yeah,
and it's I think you can't. There's no. The quality of the book has no influence on the dedication.
Okay.
Pretty much. Some are very incongruous. It says, Louise, you've given me so much. I've only myself to give to you. My heart, my soul and my body at your disposal. Dispose of carefully. Mark.
Wow.
I love these.
Why would you give someone this tatty old copy of... it's More Tales of the Unexpected. You know, it's not even...
I know, what happened? What would he have given to the person for the original Tales of the Unexpected?
Exactly, who knows?
There's a man walking around with only one arm. And what else have we got? We've got Jacques there, and I saw an Orwell, some other bits.
The Orwell one's another odd romantic gesture.
Yeah.
1984, George Orwell. This book was published in 1949. It was about the future, 1984. I've given it to you with love in 1994, the start of our future.
That's rather neat.
It's kind of neat.
It's sort of neat, but slightly psychopathic.
Yeah, it's just an odd choice. I don't think I would choose 1984 as a book to commemorate the start of a future.
No, exactly. Yeah, I want to be in charge of every single aspect of your life. Yeah, dare you look at him?
We are the dead.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got a rather handsome Penguin classic there underneath.
This is dedication written September the 26th, 1938, so 2 days before the Munich Agreement was signed. When the written word appears before us in its simplicity, then we see that in the joy of expression, we may have lost the honesty of thought, which alone makes writing worthwhile. There is no right and wrong way. The choice is between two terrible wrongs, and the most gifted and well-informed people will hesitate before coming down on either side. The events of the next few days might help us to decide. In the meantime, in prayer, an honest desire to do God's will are the only things left for us.
That's pretty heavy stuff. And this, especially with the sort of historical timing.
Yeah, the date.
A lot of these as well have that strange sense. I mean, they are like the collected letters of someone, aren't they? So you don't get the others. You don't get the other point of view. No. That does sound almost like a letter from the front.
I know. And this is signed. I mean, this isn't signed. So you don't know who.
Who doesn't sign it?
But you don't know. It sounds like he could have something to do with the events. You don't. Cause he seems very involved.
Do you think that this practice is dying out? Because I often get books and they're not dedicated.
Yeah, I do as well.
And you feel a bit disappointed, but then you think, well, you don't want to kind of, you know, urge someone to write something that if they haven't already done it. Do you think that, you know, people should be encouraged to sort of, when they're giving a gift like that, that it shouldn't just be anonymous and it shouldn't just be a fresh book?
I think it's nice to write in books when you're given a gift. Although I tend to wait until they've opened it and I keep the receipt just in case, and then I will write in it, which kind of spoils the fun a bit, unless I'm 100% sure that they don't have the book, and then I will always write.
And can you write underneath someone else's annotation?
I would never give away one of these.
Yeah, exactly.
I hang on to these ones.
Well, Wayne, thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you.
So the show opened on Friday at Foyle Bookshop on Charing Cross Road, and it runs for how long?
2 weeks, finishes December 13th.
Cool, and that is The Secret History of Secondhand Books. Well, Wayne Goodaham, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly. And a change to normal events. Sophie's brought some CDs back to it from Iceland.
From my
mum's
snowy...
been to Iceland.
My snowy exile.
So what are we going to listen to? Both of the CDs you brought back look rather handsome, but we, alas, have time for only one song.
So I've chosen a track by an artist called Mugason. I'm going to try and pronounce it Klet Njorin.
Take it away.
And that was Mugason with Klet Njorin. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour. Quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Sophie Grove.
Now, Wayne is a lover of used books, but those can be much harder to put on your wish list than something that's currently on the shelves. And if you're still preparing your Christmas Most Wanted, then stay tuned. We've invited in Paul Lay, editor of the monthly magazine History Today, to give us his picks for the best books of 2012.
Paul's brought us in five of his favourite from the world of history and non-fiction to carry you through the cold winter months, whether you're interested in the making of Christianity or the fall of the Iron Curtain. Two light subjects, Paul, to welcome you into the show.
Thank you.
Welcome to it. Presumably this is a great time of year for publishers of history books. I guess they're the kind of, this is the time when people have some time on their hands to read them.
Yeah, I suppose it is. Not least editors of History Today, but one of the things that's really striking about book publishing, history book publishing this year, is just how fantastically healthy it seems to be. I think it's probably the biggest and best selection of books I've ever had to deal with. So whittling it down to five is quite difficult.
It's a pleasurably tough task. Maybe.
Pleasurably tough, yeah, yeah. But the five books we've chosen are, I think, really outstanding, and I think they give you a sense of the real breadth of historical scholarship and writing today.
We should say they are all tomes.
They
and you should
are
be congratulated
indeed.
For bringing them in in a bag on your back.
We normally don't let people with wheelbarrows in to the gates of Midori House, but Paul's got a pocket handkerchief. He thought, "There's a man. He's bringing books.
No,
it's fine."
Indeed.
So what have we kind of got? I mean, there's, as you said, there's such a long list of things this year, and the things that have passed my desk on the culture section of the magazine and for the culture section of the radio show, it seems to be really rich too. But what made the cut, Paul?
Well, I mean, my thinking has been, apart from talking about the breadth of it all and giving people some sense of that, of just how healthy history writing is at the moment, I think it's also a mixture of real scholarship, real, real serious history, but written for the widest possible public. And I think although some of these book subjects, as you say, can be quite heavy or at least seem quite intimidating and quite, in some senses, quite esoteric and hermetic, they're actually all beautifully written, and a lot of them have real contemporary resonance as well. And so the first one I'd choose, and going right back to the beginning, is written by Barry Cunliffe. It's called Britain Begins, and it's really an outstanding survey, 500 or pages or so, published by Oxford University Press, which gives us a real sense of archaeology, ancient thought, right through from what we think of as the prehistoric, although with advances in DNA and genetic testing and all kinds of technological advances, what was prehistory is now becoming history in many senses, because stuff like DNA is a language, it's a source of some kind. So I think if you really want to know the state of archaeology, if you really want to know what the top scholars know about early Britain, then this is the book to come to. And it's wonderful, and it is one of those books that, although it's full of erudition, it's full of these little observations that you think, oh God, that's really fascinating. And there was one in particular that I think is rather wonderful, because being of a certain age, I have a slight aversion to the tattoo. And I tend to think of the tattoo, for instance, which of course is extremely modish these days, as being a very, very recent import and something like that. But of course, as Barry Cunliffe points out, that's absolutely not true at all, because the early inhabitants of Britain were noted for their tattoos. And in fact, the very name Britannia is a corruption of a word that meant the tattooed ones. So in fact, actually, it's me who's being slightly ahistorical.
I love that. We can show them our tattoos now. So
and so it's
maybe
me
after they deliver the Bloody Marys.
But it's full of great observations like that. And it's beautifully written, but it's also very, very on top of leading scholarship. This man is absolutely the top archaeologist of his generation. He's an emeritus professor. He's very, very good. And so it's a greatly entertaining read. It's also a beautifully produced book which explains the kind of structures that are there. And you can use it. It's one of those books that you can carry around you on the car, or put it on the bike or whatever. And it gives you a real understanding of that. So it's wonderful. And it's not that horrible, dry archaeology that you get occasionally, which is not about people. It's all about the people who built these things, the people whose legacy this remains. So it's a tremendous book. These are quite challenging books in a way. You know, I make the point that they're very well written, but nevertheless, they contain quite difficult arguments, what many people will find. And there's something about a book being able to linger over it and pore over it that perhaps helps to concentrate the mind, which is needed certainly in some of these books. It allows it to bring what used to be fragments in this really to life, really literally to life, with the people there and the reconstruction of those people, even what they look like to a certain extent, which is one of the interesting things about what may be Richard III, for example, under the car park in Leicester at the moment.
Yeah, right.
Is it? Is it not? Well, if it is, we really can discover now what he looks like. I mean, we rely now on Tudor portraits, often idealised. We really could get a sense of what he looks like and what people who lived 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago actually looked like.
I think a car park in Leicester is a great place to have a fight too. I mean, why not? Between historians and archaeologists, both having to use weapons from their chosen periods.
From their chosen periods, which could get pretty brutal.
It could get pretty brutal. We're going to have to move on. I think that's a great. So that was Brian Cunliffe's Britain Begins.
Yeah.
What's next, Paul?
Well, the next one, I thought, seeing as we are in London, this great city, and it's been a great year for London, I suppose most people think, with the Olympics and the Jubilee and everything else that's gone on. The great documenter of London is Dickens, of course, whose 200th anniversary is being celebrated this year. And there's been a whole plethora of books on Dickens, some very popular ones, popular biographies, right through to very dense and learned scholarly tracts. But the most exciting one is by Judith Flanders, who's a terrific historian, and it's called The Victorian City, Everyday Life in Dickens' London. And it's a great stinking sort of overflowing surfeit of information in this book. It's almost unstructured deliberately in a way, because I think one of the things that's forgotten about Dickens is that he was born in 1812, long before the Victorian period began. We think of him as the great Victorian, but of course only a certain part of his life was lived as a Victorian. And he was born into the world of the Georgians and the Regency, squalid, kind of laissez-faire world of great poverty and great wealth. What this book does is it really brings that city to life, the overflowing Thames, which is just a vast open sewer that stinks so much that eventually the House of Commons can't even sit there, and they have to finally do something about this. They reform this. It's full of wonderful little stories
about in an age of wonga as we live in. These resonate very richly of people who are so poor that they pawn a spoon or something, just one single kitchen utensil, to try and survive that week. There are these fantastic portraits of old crones coming up from the East End to pick away on the markets where those sellers of citrus fruits have just peeled lemons, say, for instance, and they take the scrappings and sell them to people who turn them into lemon drops. There are these absolutely fantastic scenes, and it's full of this. And if you want to get some sense of that kind of London that Dickens draws, it is really a very Dickensian book in that sense. It's dirty, it's filthy, but it's also rich and humane and resonant. It's a fantastic book.
Wow, well, it sounds very compelling from your rendition of it. I definitely fancy reading that one. Can you move on to your next choice? I see you've got another tome in front of you here.
Another one indeed. Well, this is a book that I suppose is resonant because of the American election. And it's by a very young Cambridge graduate student now. In fact, I think he may have become a lecturer or something like that, but he's now just about established on the first rung of a Cambridge scholarly career. And it's about the relationship between about religion, both in the United States, an incredibly religious society, and always has been, and was founded as a kind of religious culture, which I think many Europeans really find difficult to understand, because he doesn't have an established church or anything like that. This is very much a kind of free market in religious ideas, and it sustains itself now. And I think you can see the way in which America and Europe are becoming ever more separated simply because of the American focus on religion. But the great contradiction in the way that Americans think about religion is that on one side, they think of it as something that can preach a gospel of love and peace and reconciliation and helping one's neighbour. But at the other time, they see it as a kind of evangelical mission to control the world and to push their way of life, their ideals onto that world. And this is what he looks at. I mean, basically, he's merging American history with the history of Christianity. He's talking about America as a Christian empire in some sense, which goes right back to the 17th century, the founding of it, the people who founded America, the Pilgrim Fathers. They were fanatically religious. We would regard them as religious fundamentalists now.
Is there a shared style amongst these people, or do they have a very different sort of writing style?
No, I think that's a good point. I think there is great clarity in all these three writers. I think the great problem with academics and any historians at all is they get sucked into a way of writing history, as many academics do. It's not just wholly to history.
There must be some very talented editors in history publishing.
Well, there are, and in fact they owe it all to their editors. But it's all these are written almost in a novelistic way. I mean, that's certainly true of Judith Flanders' book on the Victorian City, but I think all of them are written with great clarity. If I had to pick one that was the best written of all of them, and I think I would regard him as the greatest living historian, then it's Peter Brown in his book Through the Eye of a Needle. Its subtitle, Wealth, the Fall of Rome and the Making of Christianity in the West, between 350 and 550 AD, makes it sound like an incredibly specialist work. And of course, you'd be absolutely right in saying, but...
And you open it up and it's a comic strip.
Not at all. It is the most wonderful, wonderful, rich work about the way in which the idea of wealth in the Roman Empire was very much about it was okay, wealth was great, it was on a vast scale, but it was only for a Roman. Suddenly the Christian ideal comes in that anyone can be wealthy at some point if you play the game. And what you have is this idea of, there's wonderful little bits of it. He talks about one inscription on a Tunisian bathhouse, Tunisia then being part of the Roman Empire, of course, and someone's written on there, scrawled on there, I have built more than my income allowed, but never as much as I would have liked. And what you see is that we tend to think of those days as being very, very rarefied. What we're talking about is exactly the same arguments about wealth, about the poor, that we see everywhere else. And Peter Brown writes with crystal clarity, this reads like a novel. If there was one book out of all of them that I'd recommend reading, it's Peter Brown. He is brilliant.
Well, Paul Lay, thank you so much for coming in and talking us through your five favourite history books this year. Paul Lay, editor of History Today, and you're tuned into the Monocle Weekly. We'll be back in a sec.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline. and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
We're going to have a record now from a Monocle regular, Andrew Muller.
I'm very excited about
this. Yeah, it's a strange record. It's by the North Sea Scrolls, which is a band that have been put together with Luke Haynes of the Auteurs, a great sort of pop rock musician of the English tradition, and Cathal Coughlin as well. And this is it's the mother of all concept albums, we can say that. We've chosen the most commercially viable track to choose as a single to play on the Monocle Weekly. The title of it might hopefully won't put you off. It's called I'm Not the Man You Think I Am, Karen. I'm the actor, Tony Allen. And bear with this because it is a piece of brilliant work.
By the time Tony Allen had put the final brushstrokes to the last of the Screaming Popes, it became apparent that the actor had transgressed the fourth wall. He spent the long days of his wilderness years replaying a vinyl 45, I'm On My Way by Dean Parrish, over and over again. Then, one early December morning, as the needle hit the groove one last time, Tony Allen allowed himself a rare smile, for throughout it all, he had held firm to his conviction that abstract expressionism was the least noble form of art.
And that was I'm Not the Man You Think I Am, Karen, I'm the actor Tony Allen, by the North Sea Scrolls, featuring Cathal Coughlin, Luke Haynes, and Monocle's own Andrew Muller.
Now, gallery goers at Somerset House have been seeing red since Thursday, but they're not irritated or angry. They're at a retrospective on the work of Valentino Garavandi, whose signature shade of red will deck the Embankment Galleries until March of next year.
In the studio to talk about the exhibition titled Valentino, Master of Couture, and why fashion is coming to be considered more and more as fine art, is Shona Marshall, an assistant curator at Somerset House. She's been an archivist working in fashion since she completed her studies. That's kind of a bit of your history as well. We're going back.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. You're relieved because the all the dresses are on the wall or they're hung and they're ready to...
They're all on the mannequins.
Yeah.
Just saying it was a really big, big install, you know, 6 weeks and 139 pieces, 137 full garments and a wedding dress and then one final cape. And it was just a lot of organisation behind the scenes. So we're really happy that the public are there enjoying it now.
And a big party earlier this week or last week, which always helps kind of with the public perception of something that's all about beauty and glamour, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think there's an overwhelming shout of elegance wherever Valentino goes. And I think that to have a big party really does set the scene. The exhibition explores, obviously, his work, his couture, his craft, the hands that make it. But also it delves into his life. You know, there's ephemera, there's kind of a background to it, especially the book that accompanies it is really a photography book. I think the party really kind of revealed that it is, you know, it's closeted, it's different, it's, you know, you'd never experience it.
Now, he is a man who's crafted a lot of frocks for parties, like the one that you sounded like you had a good shindig, but I wondered how you went about selecting the works to display. I mean, there were so many.
Yeah, it was so collaborative. All the dresses, bar one or two, came from the Valentino archive in Rome. And it's really, really well preserved and they have a good majority, great collection. It was always going to be only couture. There were three curators, Patrick Kimmonth, Alistair O'Neill and Antonio Monfreda. And then also Mr. Giancarlo Giametti, who's Valentino's business partner, and also Mr. Valentino. So it was a process to decide, but I know you mentioned red, and actually I think visitors will be quite shocked that red is something that's been very explored and its relationship to Valentino and how he uses it a lot. And actually, there's not that many red dresses in the show, so it really looks at different processes and spanning over 50 years. His career was over 50 years, so...
And also we talked in the introduction about how couture is becoming seen as art. There's the costume show at the V&A. I guess some of those are more well known because they come from sort of the Hollywood screen. How do you display dresses in a sort of gallery context? Make them live. They were obviously the things that were designed, as Sophie said, to be at least walked in if not danced in at parties. Yeah. So how does it work when they're static?
Well, it's really, really difficult. And, you know, it's this mannequin question that you can't...
The mannequin question.
The big question.
Oh, it's the mannequin question.
It's that. It's
fingers
that
on the buzzers.
How do you get away from them? You can't put them in real human bodies. That's not the point, you know. And it's a lot about preservation. Especially really, really old pieces are too fragile to ever be worn again. And there's a lot of conservation that goes on behind the scenes. So... In Valentino, Master of Couture, it's really an interesting kind of flip because the visitor walks down the catwalk and the audience of the couture show, it's this kind of play, role reversal, are the mannequins. And to kind of get that element of movement and humanity, they're all different colours for each decade, but also sitting, standing, facing different positions. And I think it's a bit spooky, actually, if you're in the galleries late at night on your own doing some work. And I think it is tricky to get them to breathe and live.
But it must be one of those amazing things as a curator. It's all about staging. It's about lighting. Presumably it's about putting one next to the other in the right kind of order. That's presumably when you're working with tough stuff like dresses, inanimate things, I guess that's when the skill comes out.
I mean, it's building a story. Yeah. And also it had a great team. The dressers were fantastic. It's about padding and making it look like a body. And also the lighting studio we worked with, fabulous. And, you know, spent really long time positioning each bulb to light up each dress in a certain way. And I think that's when it really works.
I wonder what you found out about Valentino, the man, while you were working on the show. I mean, he's such a curious figure, and it's amazing he's still around to promote the show and also work with you. I mean, so often the retrospectives, you know, they are really that. Do you get a sense of who he is in this show?
I think so. I really do. And I think especially personally, I obviously did a lot of research, and you do kind of get accepted after a while into seeing... How they live. And I mean, it's a completely different world. And, you know, this kind of jet set glamour, he actually lived it as much as his clients did. So he is as famous as they are now. And I think, you know, we're talking about the press interest and it's been huge. And the people he brings with him are always so interesting, royalty, you know, or pure Italian kind of glamour. And I think I did get a touch for what it was all about. But, you know, I don't... He is really curious. And I think, you know, he's endearing. But I don't feel like I know him.
I love that best friend. Well, he is rather aloof in that way. But I love the way that he manages to preserve that. And at the same time, also sort of evoke that incredible Roman sort of Dolce Vita history where he really came from. He really is a Roman.
It's what he grew up on. And I think La Dolce Vita, you know, Nita Ekberg, and then restaging, I don't know if you've ever seen the Claudia Schiffer shoot where she is in the Trevi Fountain and she's got the kitten. And I mean, there's brilliant backstage shots where it's the production and Mr. Giametti's there with all the glasses and the black cars. And I just think they captured that and they took couture and they married the two in a way that nobody else ever has. It's this, there's a certain Italianness about it that you can't quite put your finger on either, but it defines him, and it's so different from Parisian couture. It really is. I think it's sexier.
Has it made you want an entourage of your own?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so who would be in your litany? Like,
oh, I don't know.
Because I hear that Signor Valentino has... He keeps a calligraphist on staff just in case when he's having a dinner party.
I never read that. Yeah.
Just in case when there's a last minute change at a dinner party, then someone's name needs to be changed where they're sitting. Isn't that great?
That would be first on my list, as entourage-wise. Yeah. I mean, why not?
Shauna, who would be first on your list?
Well, entourage? I'm not sure.
What needs doing most?
Well, I always said if I was terribly rich, I'd have a new pair of tights every day.
Yeah.
So they were perfect. You know, there's nothing quite like a new pair
of
tights.
So you'd have a tights sommelier.
Yeah, why not?
Or tights valet.
Yeah, valet more than sommelier.
Hosiery expert. Sommelier.
Yeah, hosiery expert.
I can't think of the word.
Yeah.
That would be... I don't know if I love that. Not that indulgent, really,
not
is it?
Like wine. It's not quite the same.
And tell us about the show before we go. Tell us about the dates for the Valentino show.
So it opened Thursday 29th and it's running through to March 3rd. Open late on Thursdays if you work, and then it's 10 till 6 every day.
And if there's one dress you could walk out the out Somerset House in without the alarms going off, which one would it be? Which one would you nick?
I think there's two. One is a twin set Audrey Hepburn wore, and it's enamel flowers, just so chic and beautiful. And that would be for day, you know, if we're really pushing this out with my entourage. So in the day, I'd wear that. And then in the evening, there's a hand-painted, it has coral hand-painted and full length and just so 60s and beautiful.
That sounds pretty good, right?
Heaven.
I think we could all get away with that one. Shauna Marshall, Assistant Curator at Somerset House, home of Valentino, Master of Couture. Thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you.
The end, okay?
Already?
Sorry, you just caught us speaking. We didn't realise the microphones were on. That was a nice show. Shauna was nice, wasn't she, about talking about the Valentino show?
She was a delight. She really, she's sort of archivist. Supreme. And she is really treating these fashion items as art and treating them in the way that, you know, a curator really would. It's so interesting to see that some, you know, there are new people coming in and doing just that.
Yeah, it's cool. I kind of like that. And I like the fact that sort of like a big old place like Somerset House can sort of open up its sort of multifarious halls and corridors to these sorts of things, you know.
Also, she was just lovely. I love the idea. I think they should appoint her a hosiery sommelier just as part of her contract at Somerset House, because she deserves one.
A stocking sommelier. There'll be a queue around the block for that job, I'm sure. We've got to kiss goodbye to the viewing several, the listening several. We're going to thank our producer, David Michon, this week. We're going to thank our studio manager, who's Jack Phillips. Thank you, Jack.
Big up to Jack. Behind the glass.
And we should tell you that we'll be back at the same time, same place next week. It might be different. It might be you and I again, Sophie. Who knows? Because you're not going to be in Iceland or anywhere exotic.
Or Greenland. No.
But for the time being, thank you very much for tuning in.